This is The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM.
You're listening to The Sky Tonight, looking towards the stars each month on HCR 104 FM.
Hello again and welcome to The Sky Tonight, HCR 104 FM's monthly astronomy show, looking at the stars and discussing all the latest events in space. I'm Pete Singleton and I'm joined by Jonathan Clough of the Cambridge Astronomical Association. On this edition, we look at private citizens in space. Other space news, of course, as well, including the ongoing saga of the James Webb Telescope. When on earth will that thing actually go up? Artemis 1, scheduled for a lunar rendezvous, similar to Apollo 8 of 1968, sort of figure eight round the moon, but there won't be any humans on board this one to start with. Some more of those astronomical terms and what on earth, or what in space, maybe I should be saying, do they all mean? And, of course, what to look for in the September night sky. So first of all, let's welcome Jonathan. Good afternoon, Jonathan.
Hi there, Pete.
It should be good evening, really, shouldn't it?
It should be.
Okay. Let's look at the space news then. Now, am I likely to be able to afford a private seat on one of SpaceX's trips on Inspiration 4?
Probably not. And I think they're all booked up anyway, I'm afraid. So it is the first private citizen completely, total mission. If you remember the SpaceX mission, the SpaceX mission with the to the space station, International Space Station, a little while ago, and they had three astronauts. So they're all astronauts, they're professionals, they've been trained and all the rest of it. This is the first mission which is private citizens. I don't know what they're charging for trips of this sort, but given that Virgin Galactic are charging $350,000 and Blue Origin, I think, are charging something similar, and those are just for a 12-minute flight. Yeah. This is a three-day flight. It's a slightly different adventure. So I think we're talking millions, several millions.
It's got to be up there, hasn't it?
So we better save up the coppers a little bit for this one.
Yeah, I don't think my state pension will quite cover it.
No.
But it's being sponsored, isn't it, this trip, by a man called Jared Eisenman, and he's going to be on the flight as well.
That's right. I mean, he's a very wealthy businessman, and he's paying the ticket, and he's taking three other people with him. I think with various different. I mean, he is paying the whole bill, which is rather nice of him. And it's using a SpaceX capsule, so the same sort of capsule which went to the International Space Station on their first manned mission. I think maybe their second is planned shortly as well. The only difference between the capsule is that whereas the normal ones obviously have to dock with the International Space Station, so they have a docking mechanism on the pointy end. This one, they've taken that off because it's not going to dock with anything. It's just going to orbit for 3 days. And they've put a coupler on it, which is very like the one on the International Space Station, which is really sort of like a little window which you can stick your head into and get a really good view. So they'll be able to spend a lot of time just watching the Earth go by underneath them and looking at the stars.
So presumably, will one of them be a professional astronaut to in sort of basic language, drive the thing?
I think nominally, the Gerard Isaacman is the commander.
Oh, is he right? Okay.
But I don't think so. I think it's basically being operated under remote control. And
okay.
If you think about the original pilot mission for the Dragon capsule, which went to the International Space Station unmanned, it'll be operated remotely, and they're very much under the sort of safety of the people driving the spacecraft from the Earth.
Right. Okay. And this is taking place this month, I believe.
Yes, right. It's supposed to launch on the 15th of September. And of all the different missions we're going to talk about today, it's the only one where I haven't heard that that's likely to slip. So we can keep our fingers crossed that will go successfully.
Absolutely.
If it does, it'll be the first crewed orbital space flight since the Hubble Space Telescope servicing mission in 2009, where you're not going to go and visit a space station.
Oh,
so you think nearly everything at the moment, if it goes up there, it visits a space station. So it's orbital flights. I mean, I suppose you're getting technical here, because we've had other flights which haven't visited the space station, but they've not been orbital. They've just been, they call it ballistic. It just goes up and comes down again.
That's right.
Yes, it should be good. I imagine we'll get some nice photographs of them, A, floating around in weightlessness, and secondly, some images of what they can see.
Indeed. What do we know about Blue Origin at the moment? We know they flew Wally Funk last month, wasn't it?
Yes, it was one of the original
Mercury 13, so she went up on that. What are the news of Blue Origin?
They've had a successful flight, but this time it was an unmanned flight. And so they are setting themselves up to not just take our money to do little ballistic flights, but they're also using it as a means of getting science experiments up into space so people can do space experiments. It's a bit different from the stuff that's on the space station, because it's only up there briefly. And say the mission they successfully flew in August was only actually up there for about 10 minutes and 15 seconds. That's the complete duration of the flight. So much like the first Blue Origin flight, it launches, you have a little bit of time in weightlessness and free fall above the Kármán line for Blue Origin. We'll talk about that later on as well. And then it comes down again, and the spacecraft has two main parts. It has the launch vehicle and the capsule. The launch vehicle comes back under its own power and does a powered landing, which is always spectacular. And the space capsule comes down under parachutes. So that's very unlike SpaceX. SpaceX lands everything under rocket power. This New Origin capsule comes down like the old Apollo capsules did on parachutes, but it lands on land rather than in the sea, which is very like the Russian approach. So a bit of a combination. So this mission carried 18 research payloads, and 11 of them are from NASA. So NASA is actually paying to put payloads onto New Origin. And I know New Origin are very, very keen to get more contracts from NASA. They feel very hard done by, because SpaceX have got the contract for the moon lander. New Horizons are pushing very hard to get that discussion reopened, so maybe they can get some as well. They've actually offered to pay all the development costs, because I think they see it as so prestigious. If they can actually have a NASA mission with a moon lander, then when this whole thing goes very commercial, they'll be up in the sort of prime position along with SpaceX.
This is really, isn't it, Jonathan, that, you know, we remember the old days when it was just really NASA or maybe ESA sending things up. But, you know, now it's becoming, we're not going to be able to stop this. It's going to go on, isn't it?
It is. I mean, I think the whole purpose of both the Blue Origin, Virgin space missions, and particularly SpaceX, is to actually commercialize space and stop it being a national venture. There will still be missions to space which are so expensive that they'll have to be funded by multiple nations. Sure. But when you look at the money that's been spent by SpaceX in particular, I mean, they've spent billions of dollars. which is actually, you know, comparable with some of the other things. The Artemis program, which we'll talk about also later on, is the next NASA mission to the moon. That's cost billions and is being paid for by the American taxpayer. However, they are giving lots of contracts to these commercial operators to do bits of it. And so they're trying to keep the cost down in that way. And that then allows those commercial companies to get even more of a foothold into this. And the net result of this is that you'll end up with missions. I think there's already money on the table by one multi-billionaire to fly around the moon. And I think that's with Blue Origin, but I might be wrong. It could be SpaceX. And so, you know, going on a day trip, well, not a day trip, but a fortnight to the moon is going to be something which a multi-billionaire can start to afford and have a means of doing it.
Absolutely. But it's still difficult, and witness the problems that Boeing's had with its Starliner. It's not good news, is it?
It's really sad. It seems to just go from one thing to another. They very nearly got to a launch in July. And there were some issues at that point with the coupling of the Russian new bit of the new module to the space station. And so they delayed the mission by 3 or 4 days. So it's going to go to August the 3rd. But then when they were actually doing the final prep for this relaunch date, they found issues with some valves in the spacecraft, which they couldn't fix on the launch pad. So they've ended up scrapping the launch. And as things stand, they haven't got a new launch date. And they still haven't proved that the spacecraft is spaceworthy. If they, I suppose that's the equivalent of airworthy. Because the first mission they had, where they tried to fly to the International Space Station, they got their computer code horribly wrong. And that resulted in, it nearly resulted in a complete disaster. But what it did result in was that the spacecraft never made it to the International Space Station. It did go into orbit. It did function in orbit okay. And it did land successfully. So they're all good points. However, they still haven't proved they can get this thing to go to the International Space Station. Until they've proved that, they're not going to get the contract to fly astronauts to the International Space Station. So Boeing are struggling.
As we speak, the Ariane space, we've heard a lot about the Starlink satellites.
Yep.
That Elon Musk has sent up. But he's not the only player in the field, is he? We've now got, is it OneWeb constellation?
Yes, this was a bit of a surprise during lockdown because I don't think anybody had heard of OneWeb up to
I hadn't heard of it at all.
It was maybe a year ago, maybe slightly more than that now, when the government announced, much to everybody's surprise, that they were going to put a lot of money, I think it was $500 million or something of that order, to buy 50% of OneWeb, which was a European operation. And I think it did have a strong UK contingent and it was about to go bust. So the government effectively bailed it out by buying half of it. And what OneWeb's trying to do is something very similar to what Elon Musk is trying to do with his Starlink constellation. He's building a space-based internet system. The difference between the two is that the Starlink system, Elon Musk's version, is very much aimed at you and me, the consumer. We can buy a dish. You can buy one now. To actually use the SpaceX Starlink-based internet service. It's frankly not very useful for you and I because we live in towns and we have lots of internet options. But if you're living in the middle of Africa or the middle of a desert and there's no internet provider, then this is a means of doing it. It's a little bit like the mobile phone base or satellite-based systems before. So that's the Starlink system. The OneWeb system is actually aimed at businesses. The idea is it will provide an internet network for a business, and it'll be a global network. It'll be resilient and high speed. So although I don't know the technical details of the OneWeb system, I suspect it's probably technically slightly better as an internet service than the Starlink one. But it's probably also more expensive. It's a business-based system. And they are building the network. Starlink's, they've got several thousand satellites already in operation, and we've talked about those before. OneWeb has just got up close to the 300 satellite line. It's not trying to launch as many as Elon Musk. I mean, he's got visions of launching 12,000. So that's a whole nother game. But OneWeb have now got 288 satellites up there. They build the satellites, but the launches are provided by Ariane. And a launch from Kazakhstan and the Baikonur Cosmodrome, where a lot of the Ariane launches go from. So they have to pay for those launches as well. So it's another proposition.
Let's quickly mention in this segment, we've only got a couple minutes left of this segment, Jonathan. Let's mention Artemis 1. Then we did briefly mention it before. This is where they're going to have an unmanned test going around the moon, a little bit like Apollo 8, I assume, in December.
In December, yeah. It was always, I think the American term is slated to launch in 2021. The date's been gradually moving, and I think our latest penciled in date is the 16th of December. Mm-hmm. It was supposed to be in November. Well, that's still the official date. The Artemis program is the mission from NASA to put man and woman back on the moon. The dates which were put in place when Donald Trump was president were that they'd have the Artemis 1 launch this year. They'd have Artemis 2 launch next year. They'd have Artemis 3 launch in 2024. And it was Artemis 3 which would be the first manned mission to actually put people on the moon. Artemis 1, as you say, is the precursor and it's unmanned. And it does go to the moon. It's a 3-week mission, though, so it's a little bit unlike Apollo 8 in that it goes into orbit around the moon, whereas the Apollo 8 just slingshotted around it.
Yeah.
And I believe it goes into a retrograde orbit, which means it basically is the opposite way around the way the moon is spinning. I don't think that's particularly important. No. But it's useful because it does mean that it'll have to fire its engines to slow down when it gets to the moon to go into orbit, and then fire them again to leave the moon, whereas Apollo 8 was just on a slingshot trajectory. So it did a course correction, but it didn't have to do any firing of engines. So it's a different mission.
Okay.
And as you say... Yeah.
Sorry, John, I'll just cut you off there. We need to take a short break, but we will talk about in the next segment of the show. We will just mention the James Webb telescope. And I wanted to know if you saw any of the Perseids meteor showers last month, but we can perhaps leave that until we talk about the September night sky. But anyway, let's take a very short break.
This is The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. I'm Pete Singleton and I have Jonathan Fellows with me from the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Right, before we go any further, Jonathan, let's just mention the saga of the James Webb Telescope, which is going to be quite a brilliant sort of a piece of equipment going out into far space, but it's been delayed again.
Yes, although it's one where we don't really know to what extent it's delayed. The latest scheduled launch date was October 31st, which was why it was sort of on our agenda to talk about today. The rumours are that it might well be delayed to December. I haven't got any data or information about why that is, but given the track record, it's not a huge surprise. But we hope so. I mean, it was supposed to have been launched years ago now, so it's well late anyway. And if there are any minor niggles at the moment, then it's good that they put them together. It is the sort of successor to Hubble, but it's in a completely different position. A Hubble orbits the Earth and was accessible to the space shuttle. So we were able to do some repairs to Hubble.
Yeah, just as well.
The James Webb Space Telescope is going to a place we're not going to be able to get to in a hurry. It's going into an orbit some distance away. We're using the Earth as a sun shield, but quite a long way out. It would be probably completely impractical to launch any kind of repair mission. Mm. So it's really important that it's right first time, I think it'd be fair to say. It was also with Hubble, but the money was spent to fix it. And, we still have Hubble today. We had that glitch earlier in the year, but it's working again now, which is great. Yeah. And James Webb Space Telescope, it's less of an optical instrument, more of an infrared instrument. So that means it can actually see through dust clouds and things, which Hubble can't. Hubble takes photographs in the visual spectrum and a little bit into the infrared. James Webb Space Telescope is a much more infrared-based telescope and a higher magnification. So it should actually give us some incredible images of things which Hubble has also given us incredible images for. But it's the next step.
Sure. Thanks, Jonathan. Just at this point, I want to give out our email address. If anybody listening wants any questions answered, we'll do our very best to answer those on the next show. But the email address that you need to drop a line to is skytonight, all one word, at hcrfm.co.uk, skytonight at hcrfm.co.uk. So please do ask any questions that you want answered. And talking of questions and things, there's lots of astronomical terms that we use, but people may not always know what they mean. And when we started this little series last month, Jonathan, so let's look at some more astronomical terms and things from the glossary, if you like. Let's first of all, shall we look at the Kármán line? Now, this is an imaginary line, is it not, where space officially starts?
That's correct, and the whole area is actually almost philosophical, because there's no point when our atmosphere stops and space begins. I mean, you basically get a dilution of the atmosphere. So the higher up you go, the thinner the air gets. Theodor von Kármán, who was a Hungarian-American engineer and physicist, and he lived from 1881 to 1963, he was the first person to try and create a definition of where did space begin, but recognizing that it there's no hard line. And his theory was, well, we get to a point as you move away from the Earth when there's too little air to allow an aircraft to fly. And he came up with this, I think it was about 57 miles up, is where there's only 2% of the air left. So there's really very little to support an aircraft flying with wings. So to actually fly successfully at that height, you need to be in some sort of an orbit. You're leaking rocket engines, you're in space. So 57 miles was the level. And based on that, he came up with the line being at 100 kilometres above the Earth's surface, which is, I think, is around about the 57-mile point. So the Kármán line is the European, I hasten to add, a definition of where space begins. And it's actually confirmed by the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, which is the European body, which has got this definition of where space begins. And I make that point because NASA have got a different definition. They say space begins at 50 miles. So it's actually a little bit lower. And that's why I think it was the Virgin flight, which Richard Branson went on, went into space, because they went beyond 50 miles. But they didn't reach the Kármán line. So they didn't reach the European definition of space. So there you go. And there's lots of debate about it all.
I hope Margaret Wallace Funk remains an astronaut.
Blue Origin one went a little bit higher. And I think that might have actually reached the Kármán line from memory. I'm not 100% certain. Whereas the Virgin one definitely didn't.
Yeah. Okay, lines and belts. We've got the Van Allen belt and the asteroid belt. What can you tell us about the Van Allen belt?
Right, we're sort of moving up the heights here, because we talked about the Kármán line. So we said that's at 100 kilometres. The Van Allen belts were actually, they are belts which are charged particles, which are in a belt around the Earth. In fact, there are two belts, one higher one and one lower one. They were discovered the first one was discovered by the Explorer 1 spacecraft, which was the American response to Sputnik. Unlike Sputnik, which just had a radio thing going beep, 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 the Explorer 1 had a decent science package on board. One of the science elements was a cosmic ray detector designed by James Van Allen. And so when he got the data from the Explorer 1, he was able to identify and confirm somebody had come up with a theory, but now we have the confirmation that there were charged particles in a belt around the Earth. So his name is now famous. Just for information, Explorer 1, the person responsible for the launch vehicle was Wernher von Braun, who was the German scientist who was responsible for the V2 rockets back in the day. So a good partnership there. And you may be interested to know that the charged particles there, they've come from the sun, and they've actually arrived as cosmic particles. They're held in place by our magnetic field. So our magnetic field stops them getting any further. But they are in a belt around the Earth, which then causes problems for satellites going around, because these charged particles can actually cause issues and interference with communications and with electronic systems on board. I believe the Hubble Space Telescope, which actually on occasion has to fly through these in particular parts of its orbit, shuts down all operations, because if it carried on taking pictures while it was going through, you'd actually end up with lots of sparkly lights on your picture because of all the cosmic radiation.
Now, not that I give this much credence at all, Jonathan, but there are those who say this is why man, as in humankind, could not possibly have gone to the moon because of the Van Allen belts. Mm-hmm. How do you answer that sort of question?
I think it's like any other radiation. It depends how long you are exposed to it and how strong the radiation is. The Van Allen belts, they do cause problems for electronics, but if you're on a spacecraft which travels quickly through the Van Allen belt, you'll actually have very low dosage of radiation from them, and it's very limited. Mm. There are issues going further out, not so much in the Van Allen belts, but if you're on a mission, say, to Mars, and you're in a spacecraft for 6 months, that very much, very cosmic radiation coming from the sun is actually going to be, you know, you'll be exposed to that for the whole of the 6 months. Mm. And back to Artemis 1, which we talked about in the first segment, they will have two mannequins, as it happens, two female mannequins in the spacecraft. And those mannequins have been set up with sensors within the body cavity in all the places which would be impacted by radiation. Right. Okay. So they are going to find out whether the shielding works. One of these mannequins is going to be wearing a special vest, which has been designed as a radiation protection vest. And they want to find out whether it works. And so one mannequin wears the vest, the other one doesn't wear the vest. They'll measure the radiation both of them receive. And that will give us really useful information for that mission. And of course, we have been to the moon, and we know that the astronauts were fine, generally fine. And we actually know also that our astronauts on the International Space Station, some people have been up there over a year, and they do suffer some issues, but it's mostly to do with bone loss due to the weightlessness rather than radiation. But we do know also that the International Space Station astronauts and the Apollo astronauts reported seeing sparkles in the eyes.
So they were
seeing cosmic radiation. The answer is there is a risk. You minimize it by traveling through the Van Allen belt quickly. But there's a further risk when you're in space because you're no longer protected by the Earth's magnetic field. So cosmic radiation will be a problem. And all you can do is try and shield the spacecraft and shield the astronauts to stop them getting too much of a dose. There's still a lot of debate about how this is going to work on a trip to Mars because it's such an extended length of time. And the International Space Station is actually still protected by our magnetic field. So although we've had people on it for a year, it's not the same as being in space for 6 months.
No, sure. Well, we did have one or two other things to talk about, but I think we'll have to leave that for this week, this particular month. Perhaps next time we can talk about the asteroid belt and the Oort cloud and the Kuiper belts and things like that. But I think we really need to get on with the September night sky now, Jonathan.
Yep.
So let's, first of all, we've got a full moon. Is this the harvest moon?
It's the harvest moon. And it's a name, once again, I know I'll go back to my old farmer's almanac, but harvest moon is the full moon which occurs nearest to the autumn equinox. And we've talked about equinoxes and solstices before. The autumn equinox is the point in the year when the day and the night are equal times. And it's the point when the nights start to draw in. The night becomes slightly longer from that point on than the daytime. And it happens every year around about September the 21st. So we move into that phase on September the 21st. And as it happens, the full moon this month is on September the 20th.
Right.
So it's right bang next to the equinox. So it's definitely a harvest moon.
I won't ask you to sing the song. Right, that's our friend the moon. Let's look at the planets then, Jonathan. What can we have a look at? Neptune?
Yeah, we've got an increasing array of planets which are looking good. Neptune, it's difficult to see because it's so small. However, say that, I did actually manage to catch a picture of it a couple of nights ago. And it's strikingly blue. It's a really nice thing about it. I mean, and also, if you do manage to see Uranus, it's similar, but it's also blue. Neptune is at this position, and we talked about this in definitions last month, is at opposition on the 14th of September. And that means that we have a line with the sun the Earth, and then Neptune in a straight line. And that means that Neptune is as illuminated as it's going to get, because it's got the full disk lit by the sun, and it's as close as it's going to get. But because it's so far away, it's still very, very small. You do need a telescope to see it. And if you want to look for it, it's actually in the far, far northeast quadrant of Aquarius, just near the boundary with Pisces. And I'll leave you to find those constellations yourself.
Yeah. Okay. So what else can we look for? Jupiter?
Yep. Well, we have Jupiter and Saturn. They both went through opposition last month. So they're now just a little bit past opposition, which means they're not 100% illuminated, but it's still pretty good. And they're both getting easier to see because they're both getting higher in the sky. And once again, I saw both of those in my telescope last night. And they're good objects to see over in the, get my directions here, over in the east. Mm-hmm. And you will see Jupiter. Jupiter is in an evening object, and it's the brightest object in the sky after Venus.
Right.
And if you can see Jupiter, you can see Saturn as well, because Saturn is slightly higher in the sky, and it's over to the right from Jupiter. So find Jupiter, and you can see, if you look, got a pair of binoculars, you'll be able to see Jupiter as a disk. You might even, it depends how good your binoculars are, you might actually be able to see some of the definition of the bands on Jupiter. What I always enjoy seeing is the moons, because even with binoculars, you see the four dots of light, which are the four Galilean moons, so-called because they were discovered by Galileo, which orbit, and they're the four largest moons around Jupiter. And then Saturn is over to the right. And once again, if you've got a pair of binoculars or a small telescope, you should be able to make out that it's got a disk.
Yeah.
And it's quite nicely placed at the moment. It's not face on, so you don't see the whole disk, but you do see a nice impression of the disk lying at an angle. So you can see the disk and you can see Saturn.
It's always a nice thing to see, isn't it, Saturn? It's
lovely. I remember the first time I saw it, I didn't actually know what it was. I could see this object, and through binoculars, I knew it wasn't circular. It was very odd. And then I managed to get, I had a different telescope, I managed to get more magnification and realise what I'd found. And it was great fun.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah. We'll just take a short break. We'll continue with the September night sky after the break, Jonathan, if you don't mind.
This is The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM.
Welcome back to The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM. We're continuing with what to look for in the night sky. Jonathan, we've talked about Jupiter, Saturn and Neptune. What about Venus and perhaps Uranus?
Yeah. Venus is becoming increasingly visible. It's still quite low in the sky. It's visible soon after sunset. And if you look in the general direction of where the sun has set, but don't do it until the sun has set, because we don't want anybody looking at the sun. But it's a very bright object. It's obviously a lot smaller than Jupiter, but it's also a lot closer.
Mm.
It's our nearest neighbour. And because it's a cloud-covered planet, it reflects the sun's light and therefore is just very, very bright. With a telescope or binoculars, you'll see it's a disk. You won't see any other detail because of the cloud coverage. It's the hottest planet in the solar system. It suffered a massive greenhouse runaway effect, and it's completely cloud covered with nice sulfuric acid filled clouds. It's not a good place to visit. And then Uranus, as you mentioned, it's once again a long, long way away, but it is visible. It's just very small, and it's very late in the evening towards the end of the month. If you look in the constellation of Aries, then you might be able to spot Uranus. And it's, once again, it's a blue colour. I don't think it's as blue as Neptune. It's a different sort of blue. It's more a greeny blue, but worth seeing.
Mm. Okay. Now, what about the deep sky? Have you got anything from way into the deep sky?
Yeah, there's lots of things around. I mean, one thing we've talked about, I think, once or twice before are planetary nebulas. And the planetary nebula is nothing to do with the planet. It's called a planetary nebula because it's round. And the early astronomers could see it was round. And the only things you could actually see that were round were planets, because every other star is a dot. So actually seeing something round was a giveaway. It had to be a planet. And of course, it's not a planet. What it is a star that has exploded. It's finished its life. It's used up all its fuel. It then has a reaction, which means that it collapses in on itself, and then all of the material gets thrown out as a great big bubble of material. And because it's getting thrown out as a great big bubble of material, it comes out as a round bubble. So what we're seeing is that bubble expanding gradually, and the remnant of the star is a little dot in the middle. And you can see the little dot. And those little dots are actually very hot stars. They usually are called a white dwarf. It's the remains of the star which has crushed down on itself. So we have a few of these around. One very well-known one is the Dumbbell Nebula, which is quite spectacular. It's known as Messier Object 27, back to our friend Mr. Messier, who came up with this list of objects which were not comets, because he wanted to find comets, and he was getting fed up with people phoning him up or writing to him, I think, in those days, saying, I found a comet, and that it would be one of these planetary nebula or something like that. So it's M27. It's in the constellation of the Little Fox, Vulpecula, but that's also, it's very close to Cygnus, and Cygnus the Swan is actually pretty much straight up in the sky at the moment. It's a really nice constellation to find. And the Dumbbell Nebula is the second brightest planetary nebula, so you've got a good chance of seeing it. It's quite small, which means you need a telescope to actually get some a view of it. Mm-hmm. And it's called the Dumbbell Nebula because it appears to be dumbbell-shaped.
Yeah.
We've discovered that most planetary nebulae actually, although I talked about a bubble before, they tend to form two cones of material coming out of the star as it collapses. And in this instance, we're seeing it side on, so we can see both the cones. Other planetary nebulae, we see a circle because we're looking at it in a different direction. And another nebula, which is a very bright one, but it's very low in the sky at the moment, is the Helix Nebula. And I mention that simply because it is the brightest one. I'm looking forward to a little bit later in the year when that will be a bit higher in the sky and we can see it. And then a very pretty one is the Blue Snowball Nebula, which I did actually manage to get my telescope yesterday. And a little bit like my delight about seeing Neptune. It's very blue. Unfortunately, it's also very small. So you see a very blue object, but I haven't yet managed to get a decent picture of the definition. Mm. So they're all planetary nebula. The other thing I'd like to sort of just sort of give people a chance to see are our neighbours. All of those planetary nebula are actually in our Milky Way, but you can actually look at our neighbours just outside the Milky Way. And in particular, there's the Andromeda Galaxy, which surprisingly enough is actually in the constellation of Andromeda. It's only 2.5 million light years away, okay. Which astronomically isn't very far. And it's a very large galaxy. It's about at least twice the size of the Milky Way. Our Milky Way has somewhere between 100 billion and 400 billion stars. The Andromeda Galaxy has more like a 1,000 billion stars. Try and get all your zeros into this one. And it's significantly bigger. Our galaxy is about 100,000 light years across. And the Andromeda Galaxy is a bit bigger than that, maybe 150,000 light years across. So when you can think about those numbers and we say this is 2.5 million light years away, it actually means it all gets a bit more manageable in terms of numbers. Yeah. In the sky, it's about six times the size of the full moon. Right. But because it's dimmer, the light isn't there, you can't often see it with the naked eye. But if you happen to go somewhere with dark skies, you can sometimes just about make it out as a little smudge in the sky. If you're lucky enough to have a telescope with a camera and you can take an image of that space and you can take a long duration image, you start to get a picture of the Andromeda Galaxy. Unfortunately, it's not a lovely image of a nice spirally galaxy because it's nearly edge on to us, but you can see some of the dust lanes around it. This is quite fun. And being a neighbour, of course, it's going to come and see us sometime. It'll be knocking on our door in about 4 billion years. We're expecting a nice little collision between the Andromeda Galaxy and the Milky Way at that point.
Right.
And we'll probably end up with the two galaxies merging, probably to become an elliptical galaxy, but we'll see how that all goes. The good news from our point of view is there's a lot of space even inside a galaxy. So the chances are you won't actually have stars crashing into each other. But what you are likely to do is have disruption of both of the galaxies, creating something different, and also disturbing the areas where comets live, like the Oort cloud. And we'll probably have an Oort cloud equivalent in the Andromeda Galaxy as well. So it could be quite an exciting time with things whizzing around.
Very exciting then. Thanks, Jonathan, for that.
That's fine.
Now, last month, we had our annual meteor show. The Perseids, were you able to see anything?
I was lucky enough to be on holiday for a week last month in August.
Right,
and I went to West Wales. And I mentioned I'd had a trip to West Wales about 3 years before. And this time we were also lucky. We had 2-3 nights which were clear nights. Mm. I managed to do some imaging of other things, but we did see the Perseid meteor shower. I probably saw about 20 or 30 meteors.
Did you really?
Mostly on one night, which was the peak night for the shower. Some of them are very bright, and so it's really quite exciting. You don't have to wait for meteor showers to see meteors, but you are most likely to see them when the meteor showers are going on. Mm. I did see a news report today, actually, that there was a very bright meteor came down over Southampton on Sunday night. Sunday just gone. So if you get online and have a look at BBC South,
right. That's
where I saw it. There's a little video clip showing this incredibly bright meteor coming down. You can actually see the reflection of the meteor in the sea as it comes down. Gosh. It's that bright. And there was a suggestion it might have actually landed in France. Looking at the picture, I think it probably burnt up in the atmosphere. But, so you can see shooting stars anytime. You just need to spend a bit of time sitting in the garden and ignoring the satellites.
I did see one or two briefly, but I think where you were in West Wales, you would have had a really dark sky, wouldn't you, Jonathan?
Yes, it was tremendous. And it was, I had a nice spot with very little light outside. I was able to see various things in the sky, and I was able to show it to my family and the young children. It was just great fun. So I had a good time.
Fantastic. I had a quick look today what was making history in space on this day. And in 1977, on September the 5th, which is actually not today, but it was Sunday, Voyager 1 launches. That was 45 years ago. And what a success that's been.
Quite amazing. And, it's still working. That's the thing I find amazing. It's so long ago. It's expected to keep operating for at least another sort of 3 or 4 years. The prediction at the moment is that it's little nuclear reactor. It's not a nuclear reactor. It's powered by the decay of some radioactive material. The prediction is that the amount of energy coming from that material will go to such a low level in about 3 or 4 years' time. There will not be enough power to run the instruments.
But 1970s technology.
It's done pretty well, yes. They always said Apollo was like that, wasn't it? Yeah. How on earth did they get to the moon with something which had less power in it than your phone? But
I think they've sent up some software updates sort of on occasion, haven't they?
They have, but it's been very limited because actually has such a limited memory.
And of course.
And also the knowledge of how to do this is going. So there are some fairly grey-haired astronomers in the NASA team who are working on this. And then a nice little quiz question point is that Voyager 1 was actually launched 16 days after Voyager 2. So sure. Voyager 2 went first.
Well, Voyager 1 is the one that has the little golden disc on, isn't it?
It is, yes.
And apparently it's 40,000 years before the next encounter with anything, remotely like that possibly might have alien life on it.
Yeah, it's not going quickly enough to actually make a short journey to the nearest star. I mean, our nearest neighbours in stellar terms are maybe 4 light years away. And, it takes light 4 years to get there. So our little Voyager 1 travelling, even though it's going at an incredible speed, will take tens of thousands of years to get there. There are lots of discussions about how we could send spacecraft to the nearest star and do it more quickly. The fastest I've heard about is something travelling 1/5 the speed of light, which would take 20 years to get there. And once it got there and sent a signal back, that would take 4 years to come back.
Exactly.
And we would have no way of slowing it down. So it would be going at 1/5 the speed of light as it got to the star system. It would only be there for a little bit of time.
Indeed, yeah.
Yeah.
I always think, though, those men and women who worked on the Voyager mission, they must be getting quite elderly now. And it must be a fantastic feeling to think that that's, their work. I suppose it's been their life's work, really.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, I think many space missions are so long in the design and then the launch and then the making it work. I mean, our latest deep space mission in a similar vein is New Horizons. And that's still out there. We didn't talk about the Kuiper Belt, but it's out there looking at Kuiper Belt objects. It's already looked at Pluto and it's still there looking at things. And the Kuiper Belt is only about 50 astronomical units from us. Voyager's 150, so it's three times the distance past Pluto. That's a pretty amazing number, isn't it?
Indeed. Okay, Jonathan, well, let's have a look on what's going on the Cambridge Association or anywhere else for that matter. But start off with your own association.
Yeah. Well, the good news is we're no longer the only show in town. I shouldn't sort of do this, but there are some others. Anyway, let's quickly go through them. Cambridge Astronomical Association, we have a talk on the 17th of September from Dr. James Trusler, who's going to tell us why galaxies die. Anybody who's seen our listings might have noticed that we did have Sir Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, talking to us in September. That's been rescheduled to March, so don't worry, he is coming, but we'll hopefully see him in person rather than via a Zoom call in March. Okay. We then have our young astronomers have a meeting on Saturday, 25th of September. We're talking about space stations, building a model, playing a game. So if you've got youngsters up to about age 11 and they want to participate, have a look at that one. And then I put in an October date because it's probably going to be before our next programme.
Yeah.
Monday, the 4th of October, we've got our Cambridge Astro Plus group. And they're going to talk about the history since Sputnik. About all of the different satellites, what's been going on, and just how cluttered is space around the Earth.
Okay.
So that's the CAA. The Cambridge Institute of Astronomy, the university, will start its public viewing in October, and that will be starting around about the 6th of October, so very close to our next broadcast, and that's a weekly event going forward, and CAA supports that, but worth watching for. Letchworth and District Astronomical Society, they have a talk on September the 29th about the rise of a giant, the extremely large telescope. We're very good at naming telescopes, aren't we? Okay. The extremely large telescope has a huge mirror, 39 metres across. So that'll be able to see lots, basically. And it'll work in tandem with the James Webb Space Telescope and the Hubble. King's Lynn and District Astronomy Society have a talk and an AGM on Monday the 13th of September about what the Egyptians did for astronomy. And they also have an outreach event on the 24th of September, which is the Deepdale Festival, which is a stargazing dark sky event. And then on the 25th of September, we have the Norfolk Coast Dark Skies Festival, which sounds great fun. If you're able to get to that one. And then finally, St. Neots Astronomy Association are actually restarting their meetings as well. So the first meeting was actually on the 6th of September, but they're now meeting, I think, on a monthly basis at the Little Paxton Pitts Nature Reserve.
Great, Jonathan. Thanks ever so much for that information. And I think you've done extremely well this month. We've not had Paul with us, as usual, but I think we'll call this the Jonathan Clough Show.
Oh, thank you very much. No, it's been good.
Anyway, thanks ever so much, Jonathan, for all your prep. It's been great to meet you again, and we'll hope to see you again next month. So this, dear friends, has been The Sky Tonight from HCR 104 FM, presented by me, Pete Singleton, with input and research from Jonathan Clough from the Cambridge Astronomical Association. Coming up at 10, it's The Late Show with Tony Obi, following the news and local weather at 8. It's Rock and Roll with John Rea. So from all of us in this particular part of the universe, until next time, on October the 6th at 7 o'clock, we wish you a very good night. Good night.
The Sky Tonight on HCR 104 FM.